I want to start with something that a thinker, a writer called Ken Wilber. You've probably come across Ken Wilber, or some of you might have come across Ken Wilber. He's a sort of he's a polymath. He's a sort of synthesizer of various disciplines, including physics and Eastern mysticism and all sorts of things. Anyway, this is something that he said, and it's a few paragraphs, so I'll just read it out. He says, it's flat out strange that something, that anything, is happening at all. There was nothing, then a big bang, then here we all are. This is extremely weird. To Schelling's burning question, why is there something rather than nothing, there have always been two general answers. The first might be called the philosophy of oops. The universe just occurs. There is nothing behind it. It's all ultimately accidental or random. It just happens. It just is. Oops. The philosophy of oops, no matter how sophisticated and adult it may on occasion appear, and its modern names and numbers are legion, from positivism to scientific materialism, from linguistic analysis to historical materialism, from naturalism to empiricism, it always comes down to the same basic answer, namely, don't ask. The question itself, why is anything happening at all? Why am I here? The question itself is said to be confused, pathological, nonsensical, or infantile. And to stop asking such silly questions is, they all maintain, the mark of maturity, the sign of growing up in this cosmos. Well, I don't think so. I think the answer these modern and mature disciplines give, namely, oops, and therefore don't ask, is about as infantile a response as the human condition could possibly offer. And then he comes on to the other broad answer. He says the other broad answer that has been tendered is that something else is going on behind the happenstance drama, is a deeper or wider or higher pattern or order or intelligence. There are, of course, many varieties of this deeper order, the Tao, God, Geist, Mart, archetypal forms, reason with a capital R, Mahamaya, Brahman, Rigpa. And although these different varieties of the deeper order certainly disagree with each other on many points, they all agree on this, that the universe is not what it appears. Something else is going on. Something quite other than oops. So that's very good, isn't it? So in a way, I don't think I'm going to be able to provide any concrete answers to anything. But what I want to try and illustrate in this talk is that something else is going on. That common sense kind of world that we experience, a common sense world view through our senses, is not reality. It's not what really is going on. Something much, much more mysterious is going on, but we don't perceive it with our ordinary senses and with our common sense reason. So that's what I want to try and illustrate. And I find it very interesting that a lot of people think of themselves as sort of hard-headed, rational people in our culture. And they think that they're being scientific when they're, you know, using that sort of reason. And they think that it's scientific to assume that the whole world, the whole cosmos, is made up of matter, and that matter is all there is. And matter, they think, is stuff, and we may not exactly know what stuff means, but it's ultimately reducible to smaller and smaller pieces, little bits, And yes, scientists keep finding smaller bits, but ultimately they'll find the smallest bit, and then we'll be able to say that the whole cosmos is made up of these small bits. That's a sort of common sense materialist, scientific materialist kind of perception, view. But the point is, it is a view. It's not it's not necessarily reality. But it seems to be that in our culture it's become the sort of default view. And the irony is, and this is really ironic, is that science, particularly physics, for over 100 years, or at least 100 years, has been contradicting that view. And certainly since the 1920s, it's been contradicting this view of common sense reality being just like we think it is, we observe it is, made up of smaller and smaller bits that exist out there. Science has been saying something very different for nearly or probably over 100 years. At least physics has been. And physics says or tries to be the science that really does probe what's going on. What's out there? What is going on? It looks at matter, it looks at space, it looks at time. And what I want to show is that it comes up with the most bizarre conclusions, which there is no, at the moment, no consensus on what they mean. But it just does come up with some very, very bizarre notions that overturn those common sense assumptions on our head. Einstein said that common sense is nothing but the deposit of prejudices laid down in somebody by the time they reach 18. And Einstein was quite anti-quantum physics. Maybe I'll come back to that. But he was... let me read you something more by Einstein. He's very quotable, actually, is Einstein. Not just because he had a way with words, but because I think he was genuinely in touch with the wonder and mystery of what's going on. And he said, or at least one of the things he said, is that the most beautiful thing that we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and all science, the mysterious. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. His eyes are closed. And of course he could have said, she is as good as dead. Her eyes are closed. So I think this is really interesting, because I think this view that, well, we'll come on to, in a way, some of this sort of wonder and mystery that physics exposes. But unfortunately, this wonder and mystery that physics finds hasn't necessarily made its way into some of the other scientific disciplines and into popular culture. I was talking to somebody who's a biologist, and I don't really know anything about biology, but he was saying that in biology there's still very much a materialist view of what it is to be alive. So the body, for example, is treated as some sort of organic machine, yeah, that can be broken up into its component parts, each of which has a function, and when you put the whole thing together, it exhibits what we call life. And of course, one of the very crucial things, particularly when it comes to the Dharma, is that in such a view, what we think of as consciousness is said to just arise from neurons in the brain. Yeah? And of course, I'll steer clear of brain science, because Glenn is here, and he's actually a neuroscientist. But all I can say is the brain is very, very complicated, and Glenn would agree. Thank you, Glenn. The brain is phenomenally complicated. But philosophically, no matter how complicated it is, philosophically, that doesn't answer the question of how, if matter is just inert stuff, how that can give rise to this experience of being conscious. How can inert stuff suddenly see colour and experience love and be alive? There seems to be a sort of obvious question there. And most scientists sort of ignore that conundrum. Not all. Most scientists ignore that conundrum. Or at least the scientific world view ignores that conundrum. I shouldn't speak about most scientists because some scientists seem to have, they can have sort of religious views or spiritual views that are at odds with their own scientific perspectives. It's as if they probably go into their labs and offices and put on their science hats, and then privately they might do something quite different, pray or whatever it is. And that can't be right, can it? That can't be right. If we're searching for truth, there can't be just like two very different truths. Whatever physics is looking at, whatever Buddhism is looking at, even if we're looking in very different directions, even if those two spheres of discipline and discourse come from very different directions, they're both trying to get to the nature of reality. And they ought to be pointing to the same truth. So I'm very excited because I think physics does start to point to some of the, or it hints at some of the things that Buddhism has been saying for thousands of years. So I want to try and illustrate some of the weirdness of quantum physics by the classic two-slit experiment. Have you all heard and seen something of the two-slit experiment? It helps probably if some of you have, at least. I'm going to give it a go. You'll just see. It's a bit weird. But it's also quite simple. As an experiment, and I'm not going to do the experiment, I'm just going to do a flip chart version of it. Because to do the experiment, you'd need, I don't know, millions of pounds and a laboratory and all sorts of things. So I'm just going to do a little flip chart demo of what happens, get me to pause and ask questions if you're not clear. So the experiment starts with a sort of assumption that all the stuff of reality, all the stuff of the cosmos, and this is physics speaking, remember, so physics isn't interested in consciousness. It doesn't have anything to say directly about consciousness. Physics assumes that there's a world out there independent of mind, of me and you. Yeah? That there's stuff out there. And it assumes that all the stuff, all the matter out there can be broken down into smaller and smaller particles, elementary particles. And then there's another form of energy out there which manifests as waves. Just as, water can have ripples on the surface. Those sorts of ripples are waves in water. And sound, for example, is a wave formation in air that then is picked up by our ears, etc., etc. So you've got energy manifesting as waves. And then you've got matter that can be... Matter is somehow stuff. So one of the things about waves that differentiates them from matter is that waves seem to spread out in space. Yeah. So if I drop a pebble into a pond, you get ripples that spread out across the surface of the pond. That's slightly different, that sort of spreading out quality in space is different to what matter seems to do. Matter seems to be like little bits of stuff, smaller and smaller bits of stuff that exist in one place. Yeah? Like little tiny ball bearings that exist in one place. They don't spread out. At least classically, that was the theory. 19th century physics was all based on this assumption, or these assumptions, or at least it had those assumptions in there. So what I've got is a little diagram. Some of you might not be able to see. I'll sort of move the flip chart around. Some waves. I'll have to explain this diagram because it's a schematic. Obviously, it's a schematic rather than a picture. What I've got here is a source of waves, and in this case, I've drawn it as a light bulb. This experiment was a 19th century experiment conducted by a scientist called Young, and he used it to show that light exhibited wave-like properties. Because what he did was, I'm showing these kind of ripples that you'd get in water, but they're ripples of light in this case. You could imagine it as water if you wanted to. Then here, there's this barrier, this green line. Can everybody see this? There's this sort of barrier, and in the barrier there are two holes, normally called slits, two slits. And when the waves or ripples hit those two holes, well, they hit the barrier and they go through the holes. But because now you've got two holes, it's as if you've got two sources of waves, two sets of waves spreading out. And what happens is that they overlap. You know, if I dropped two pebbles into the pond, there would be two sets of ripples and they'd overlap. And what happens with a ripple has a sort of peak and a trough. A wave has a peak and a trough. And when you get two overlapping waves, they're going to do something like this. And when two peaks come together, they'll enhance, they'll add up and form a bigger peak. Yeah? When two troughs come together, you know, two troughs, they'll form a bigger trough. And when a peak meets a trough, I've never done wave demos like this. It's quite good, isn't it? When a peak meets a trough, if they're the same size, they'll just cancel out and there'll be no disturbance at that point. So what you've got is these overlapping waves spreading out and interfering with each other. Yeah? And then here you've got a screen measuring how much of the wave hits this screen. So if this was light, you'd just measure how bright the light is at each point in this screen. And what happens is that you get bright bits of light, and then you get dark strips, and then bright strips, and then a darker strip, and then a brighter strip, and a dark strip, and then a much brighter strip, and then a dark strip, and then bright strip, dark strip, bright strip. Yeah? You get these bands of light. Because where the dark strips are, that's where a peak met a trough and it all cancelled out and there was no light. Yeah? And the bright strips are where there was more light because a peak met a peak. Or quite simple, simply sort of put, that's what's happening. So this pattern of bands of light and dark is a signature for waves. Only waves will do this. Only waves will pass through each other and interfere in this way. Ripples in water will do it, but if you had two rocks flying at each other, they wouldn't pass through, would they? They'd just bounce off each other or break or something. Matter, stuff, doesn't pass through and ripple like that. Yeah? So far, so clear? So then, let's look at what matter does. I'm going to now look at electrons. So this little red thing is a source of electrons. It's some radioactive substance that fires off electrons randomly. Yeah, it actually fires them in all directions. But in this diagram, I've got a barrier just with one hole, and I've called it A. Just one hole. And so some of these electrons, most of them are going to hit the barrier and get absorbed in the barrier. But some of them are going to you know, they travel in straight lines, and some of them are going to make it through the barrier. And I've just shown this kind of dotted line as a path of those electrons as they sort of make it through the barrier. And they're going to land, because they travel in that straight line, they don't spread out like waves. Imagine rocks. Imagine sort of, you know, imagine stones. Say you've got a wall in front of you with a gap in it. And you have a pile of stones and you try and throw them through the gap. And it's not a huge gap, it's quite a narrow gap. So you're throwing them through the gap. You miss quite a lot of the time and they just bounce off the wall. But when you're more accurate, they go through the gap in the wall and they land on the other side. Because the gap is sort of finite, it's wider than one of the stones. Some of them are going to go at that angle, some of them are going to go through at that angle, and they'll land in a slightly different place, but you'll form a pile of stones the other side of the wall. Yeah? So similarly, you get a pile of electrons here. Does that make sense? So far, so straightforward. Electrons just stand for, in this case, a subatomic particle. So then, this is an illustration of two slits again. Now we've got slit A and slit B. And what I'm showing here is electrons, some of them now going through the lower slit, and some of them going through the top slit, A, and forming two piles. So it's a bit like you've now got two holes in the wall, and you're going to end up with two piles of stones the other side. Yeah? Well, no. Because this isn't what happens. When they actually did experiments with subatomic particles, electrons, and I'll come back to light in a minute, this is what you'd expect. This is what you'd expect. You'd expect two piles of stuff, of electrons. But actually, what they got... Actually, what they got was this. They got sort of this wave interference pattern forming on the screen. So it was as if some electrons landed there, none landed in this bit, some more landed there, none landed there, none there, some there, etc., etc. Only, and if you allowed millions of electrons to go through, eventually you got this pattern of strips of light and dark. And what's really weird is that most of them, the highest sort of peak, is directly in line with the wall. It's as if you were throwing pebbles or stones at these two holes in the wall, and your biggest pile of stones ended up directly in front of you where there was no hole. It's like the stones had suddenly done this weird thing. And in fact, they'd ended up in many piles, not just randomly, but in the way that a wave would do. That's how strange that is. The only conclusion that people could make, the only conclusion that one can make from this, is that these electrons are behaving as waves. Yeah? They're behaving as waves. You can slow this thing right down so that only one electron is fired at a time. And you still get this pattern. And the only answer for that is that the electron is not going through just slit A or slit B. It's behaving as a wave, going through both, interfering with itself, cancelling out the peaks and troughs, and then landing at one of these places, causing a point of light, but only landing where a wave would land. Yeah, that's really, really weird, isn't it? You start to see something of the weirdness. Yeah? It gets weirder. So light also does this. So in the 19th century, there was a bit of a debate about, was light a wave or was it a particle? Yeah? And Thomas Young showed that it was a wave, but actually Einstein showed that it was a particle. And these days, we know it can be either or sort of neither. But it can be a wave and it can be a particle. An electron similarly can be waves or particles. Let me show you how weird this gets. So remember that this electron, when there was just one hole, yeah, wasn't behaving as a wave. It was behaving as a particle going through the hole like a well-behaved pebble and landing where it should if it was a pebble. You introduce two holes and they behave like waves. That's really strange, isn't it? Somehow, how does it know that there are now two holes and it should behave like a wave? So scientists thought, well, let's try and actually see the electron as it goes through these two slits. Let's try and see, first of all, is it going through one or both? Or if it's going through one, is it going through the top one or is it going through the bottom one? So you can cleverly, I don't quite know how this is done in practice, but you can cleverly set up detectors, little detectors, to check whether the electron is going through that top slit or whether it's going through that bottom slit or both. Yeah? So they did experiments with these detectors just to try and find this electron as it goes through. But the weird thing was that as soon as you put these detectors in place, the electron decided to behave as a particle. So now it would go through one or the other, depending on which one you looked at. And enough electrons would go through both. But they'd be definitely well-behaved particles. As soon as you decided to measure which slit they went through, or look at which slit they went through, they decided, oh no, I'm a particle after all. I'm a pebble. And I'll be a well-behaved thing. And then you just get these patterns. Yeah? So that's really strange, isn't it? It starts to get really, really strange. So some people thought, maybe these detectors are getting in the way, and it's the sort of placing of the detector, the measuring device, that is causing this strange behaviour somehow. But you can remove one of the detectors. So now you've only got one detector on one of the slits. And what happens is now the electron, if it doesn't go through the top slit, this detector won't bleep or anything. So if this thing doesn't bleep, you know that it's gone through the bottom slit, don't you? Yeah? If that detector doesn't detect it, it's gone through the bottom slit. But even when that happens, the electron decides that, oh yes, you know which slit I've gone through, I'll behave as a particle. Yeah? Now you haven't touched it, you haven't measured it, you've just measured that it didn't go through the top slit. But as soon as you know that it hasn't gone through the top slit, it decides to behave as a particle. And then soon as you remove these and say, okay, I'm not looking, then it'll behave as a wave and land in all these weird places. Yeah. So then, a guy called Wheeler thought of an experiment called the delayed choice double-slit experiment, which was even weirder. What he said was, let's devise an experiment where we let the electron get through this barrier somehow, regardless of whether it's A or B or both, let it get to this region, and then we will randomly decide whether we want to measure which slit it went through or not. Yeah? So we'll wait until it's definitely got through, and then we'll cleverly, sneakily, either put a detector in or not. You know, sometimes we won't, randomly, and sometimes we will, randomly, and let's see what happens. And the incredible thing is that even after it's past this point of no return, you know, it's gone past this point, if you put these detectors in place, or one of them in place, if you try and work out which slit it went through, then it'll be a well-behaved particle. And it'll either go through slit A or slit B. If you choose not to measure, then it'll behave as a wave. It's as if the electron has gone, not exactly back, it's almost like, well, one way of thinking about it is it's after it's gone through this slit, it sort of decided to go back in time and decide which slit should it have gone through, depending on whether you have chosen later on to measure it or not. Yeah? That's very, very, very peculiar, isn't it? Very, very peculiar. So, nobody really knows why this happens. Nobody has any real understanding of why this happens. This is fundamentally incomprehensible according to rational thinking. And it's 100 years later, it's still incomprehensible. But different physicists have different interpretations of what's going on. And I'm just going to give you one interpretation. And it's, or at least when I was studying physics, it was the standard interpretation. I'm not sure it's the most popular interpretation anymore, but I think it's still the only one to me that seems at all likely. And this interpretation is called the Copenhagen interpretation. And what that interpretation says is that when you're not looking, the electron is not a wave, it's not a particle, it's not even definitely existing. It's just a set of probabilities and potentials. It sort of exists only in a ghostly way of probabilities and potentials. And mathematically, those probabilities look like a probability wave. So the electron doesn't have, for example, a real location. You can't say it's there or it's here. All it has is a probability of being here and another probability of being there and actually another probability of being on Mars. It's got probabilities of being anywhere in the entire universe. Some of them less probable than others. But it's only when you actually try and observe it, does one of those probabilities turn into an actuality? Does it turn into reality? Does the electron decide that, oh, it should be here, or it should be as a wave across space? Somehow the act of observation creates the reality. That's outrageous, isn't it? That's sort of outrageous, that the act of observation creates reality. And then, of course, you get into philosophical problems as to what is observation. And I haven't got time to go into some of the experiments that have been done. It's called the measurement problem in physics, this. And there isn't a real answer to the measurement problem that everybody agrees upon. But, I won't go into von Neumann, but there's a mathematical kind of foundation to quantum theory that says that it's the act of observation, the act of knowing that determines the outcome, the reality. It's not something to do with a measuring device. It's not even something to do with a computer detecting something. It's not to do with even your eyes detecting something. It's something to do with the act of knowing. That's really weird, isn't it? Yeah. So then, physics has to start talking about consciousness. And physics didn't, you know, have anything to say about consciousness. It's never studied consciousness. And it's just assumed that consciousness is matter in a very complex brain function. But suddenly physics is saying, the act of observation matters. We matter. Because we are observers. And it's as if we are creating the world through our seeing it. Yeah? Through our imagining it. Which is really, really profound. It completely overturns this notion that there's an objective reality out there. A real objective universe out there, independent of me. Shall I tell you just one more strange experiment? You know, I talked about the delayed choice experiment, where you wait until it gets through. One scientist has dreamt up a very, very delayed choice experiment. Instead of using electrons, he's using photons, which are particles of light or light. But he suggested that why don't we use photons that come from outer space? In fact, why don't we look at a quasar, which is an incredibly bright object? Let's look at a quasar that's billions of miles away, billions of miles away, so that it takes years for the light to reach us, like billions of years. So it's a really, really far away thing. Yeah? Let's look at this quasar, and instead of two slits, let's find a quasar which has two galaxies between us and it. So now there are two galaxies. And what happens is that the light from this quasar will either sort of go through one galaxy and form a particular path to Earth, or it'll go through another galaxy and form a particular path to Earth. It will sort of be bent by the galaxies and form a particular path, yeah? So now, these photons, for billions of years, have been traveling in space. One of them goes through galaxy A, one of them goes through galaxy B, and then on Earth, billions of years later, we can either choose to find out which galaxy they came from, which path they followed, through particular telescopes, or we can use mirrors to just sort of display the photons on a screen like this. And what happens when we look? What happens is that if we choose to measure whether it's galaxy A or galaxy B, then the photons behave as if they really did go through one or the other. If we choose not to look, then we get this interference pattern. Now, these photons left that quasar billions of years ago. Billions of years ago. And when we look, they either go through one or the other, or if we don't measure it, they go through both and interfere with themselves. So suddenly, what we're saying is that these photons, even though they left this quasar billions of years ago, they don't actually exist. They don't actually exist according to this interpretation. They're just probabilities. There's a probability that it'll go that way through this galaxy, that way through that galaxy, or if you're not looking, both probabilities will manifest. And then only when you look will the path be really determined. Billions of years later you look, and you're somehow determining what happened billions of years ago. Isn't that strange? So that changes your notion of time. We normally think of the past as having happened. Yeah? But if things only happen when you look, And now you're only looking at something that sort of happened billions of years ago. It's now only happening now. So that's very, very strange. So it changes time. It changes our notion of what time is. Other quantum experiments that I'm not going to go into challenged the notion of separation in space. Normally you think of two objects as, if they're separate in space, that they're distinct objects. Other experiments in quantum physics say, oh no, even if two objects are separate in space, they behave as if they're not. They behave as if they're just one thing. But we won't go into that. So space and time and matter are all being challenged. And consciousness is somehow in this game again. The observer is in this game. So why this is so interesting for us as Buddhists is that Buddhism has always said that this sense that there's a real world independent of me, in fact, that there's a real me and then a real world, that is a deluded way of perceiving. It's natural, but it's deluded. Buddhism is saying, no, that's not what's going on. There isn't a real me or a real world. Something much more mysterious is going on. So let me just pause there, first of all, and see if there are any questions. I've probably bamboozled you all. Priscilla.
If the sides behave like a wave, is it deciding?
Is it deciding? And what does it mean to say an electron? Yeah, indeed. What does it mean to say that an electron decides? But how? I mean, the language is just daft, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But somehow it knows. I mean, this is poetic language. A physicist wouldn't use this language. A physicist tries to avoid saying anything, actually, about what's going on. A physicist just says, let's look at the equations and you'll work it out. But as a sort of ordinary layman, it's as if the electron knows whether it's being watched or not. And when it's being watched, it manifests. And depending on what you're looking for, it'll manifest differently. If you're looking for it to be a wave, it says, okay, I'll be a wave and go through both holes, or both galaxies, or whatever it is. Because waves can. If you're looking for it to be a particle, then it says, oh yes, I'll behave as a particle, and only go in one direction. It says, if it knows. Now, one of the interesting things that I find in terms of the Dharma is that the Dharma says there isn't anything inert out there. This notion that there's just inert matter and that we are thrust into a universe, a cosmos of inert matter, and it's all going on out there, that the Buddha said that's not how it is. The Dharma says that's not how it is. It would be better to think, I mean, this is still a sort of as if, but it would be better to think of matter as being alive or conscious. It would be better to think of consciousness as being the primary reality, and that matter is somehow a phenomenon that emerges out of consciousness. Which is the reverse of how we normally think about it. We think of matter as somehow real, and consciousness as being some sort of byproduct of matter when it gets into complicated patterns of the brain. Yeah? But Buddhism, at least later Buddhism, would say that it's more true to say that what's going on is of the nature of mind, and that form is a sort of manifestation of mind. Everything actually is a manifestation of mind. But
no. Are you saying that we are actually creating the outcome, depending on whether we're observing it or not?
And in what way we're observing it?
So we're creating the outcome.
Yeah.
Whichever way we decide, yeah, we are observing.
Yeah.
So the fact that the outcome is dependent on us.
Yes.
It means really that, you know, it's not really, you can't really say it was there or...
Exactly. That's exactly it. So we're co-creators of the outcome. Something seems to be happening, but we can't fully define what is happening when we're not looking. And somehow, when we observe things, we help create the outcome. And so in this interpretation of quantum physics, the Copenhagen interpretation, the observer and her mode of observing has to be seen as part of the whole experiment. It's not that you or I is somehow outside of the experiment. We, if we're a scientist and we're observing, we are part of what's going on. There's no separation. We can't become an objective observer, because there is no objective universe. Yeah. Now, Einstein hated this interpretation. He just said quantum theory must be wrong or incomplete. That he hated this notion that there wasn't an objective reality. He thought that was the whole point of science, that you looked for what the objective world was. So he spent the rest of his life after, you know, from the 1920s, trying to find holes in quantum theory. And he wasn't able to. Yeah? He wasn't able to.
But that doesn't mean that it can't be found.
No, that's true. So quantum theory could be proven wrong. And in fact, it probably isn't the last word on what's going on, because physics hasn't yet managed to fit the theory of gravity, for example, into quantum theory. It probably isn't the last word of what's going on. But over the last 100 years, physicists have tested quantum theory against experimentally observable facts again and again and again, and it is the most successful theory of matter that we've ever had. I mean, successful in scientific terms, it's successful to an incredible precision. Yeah, because I've just talked in rather sort of general terms, but actually you can work out in a numerical way what should be happening. And quantum theory, time and time again, is incredibly successful. I mean, so successful that nobody can say that it can't be pointing to some sort of truth. But people have been looking for, yeah, maybe there's something else going on. But all I know is that if there is a better theory that emerges, it will have to explain everything that quantum theory already explains. This, what I've shown you, will happen regardless of the theory. This is what happens. Do you see what I mean? So any other theory will be even weirder, or equally weird. Common sense has just gone. We can't have it back. We can't hope that we'll have a theory of matter that will restore everything to common sense. It won't, ever. Yeah. And then the other objection sometimes is that quantum theory might apply just to the very, very small, but it can't apply to tables and flip charts and planets and stars and galaxies. But actually, it does. There's no sort of cut off when the small becomes big and one theory stops working and another starts happening. There is only one sort of truth. But what's even more striking is that there are large scale phenomena that are happening in the universe that can only be explained in terms of quantum theory. So for example, if you want to know why the sun shines, you need quantum theory. Yeah? Why it still shines, why it hasn't stopped shining millions of years ago. You need quantum theory. If you want to know why electricity flows through metals, you need quantum theory. Without quantum theory, we wouldn't have invented the semiconductor. And semiconductors, I'm not going to go into them, are used in transistors. And they're used in silicon chips, computer chips. Without quantum theory, you wouldn't have computer chips. You wouldn't have all the technology that we carry around in our pockets, in our dishwashers, etc., etc. All of that is dependent upon quantum theory. Isn't that incredible? Yeah. So we live in the quantum world. But I want to go back to this kind of consciousness thing. So one of the metaphors that later Buddhism uses is the metaphor of a dream. So when we have dreams at night, we think that they're really real. Yeah, we can have a dream. I had a dream last night where I think I was being followed or sort of chased or something. There was something going on. I can't quite remember it. But in that dream, at the time, it felt really real. And you can experience all the emotions that go with the story of that dream, including bliss, fear, joy, contentment, whatever it is, sadness, loss. You can experience it all. But when you wake up, none of it feels absolutely real. You still get a bit of a hangover of the dream sometimes, don't you? But you know that, that was a dream, and that's less real than my waking life. Yeah? Well, Buddhism says this waking life is analogous to a dream. And if we woke up, if we could be enlightened, if we saw as the enlightened mind sees it, we would know that what we take for this real waking experience is as a dream. That it is somehow conjured up by mind. It's as if we're all sharing a collective dream, and we're calling that reality. And the thing with Buddhism, now the Buddha wasn't interested in physics. He didn't know about physics. He wasn't even interested in philosophy. What the Buddha was concerned with was that because we mistake this waking life for reality, because we mistake the dream for reality, we suffer. It causes us pain. We keep getting it wrong. And he was interested, concerned with the alleviation, the transcendence of all pain, of all suffering. And that's what the whole path is about. It's not about quantum physics. It's not about even what's really going on. It's about how do we wake up from the pain that we cause ourselves and each other. But it so happens that if we move towards reducing our delusion, then the pain goes, or the pain is similarly reduced. So the Buddha transcended all pain by transcending all delusion. And the fundamental delusion that he transcended was that there's a real me in here and a real objective world out there. Yeah? That something more mysterious is going on. There is something happening, but in a dream there's something happening. It's just that it's not what we think it is. Yeah? So it's not nothing, because that would be a nihilism. It's not that there isn't something going on. It's not that you aren't sitting here and I'm not standing here. But we're misinterpreting it so badly that we couldn't be more wrong. And then we bump into each other and we cause pain to ourselves and other people. One of the things, as soon as I say there's a real me and a real world, one of the immediate issues that arises is, oh goodness, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. And there's this inescapable fact which is coming towards us, which is going to be painful, if I think there's a real me. An analogy that I quite like, an image that I quite like, and it is only an image, and you mustn't take it too literally, is of an ocean. Imagine there's an ocean. Reality is an ocean. Imagine it's an ocean that's shoreless, if you can imagine such a thing. So suddenly you've got this infinite ocean. Yeah? It's shoreless and infinitely deep. And yet it has a surface. But below the surface it's infinitely deep. And it's shoreless. And on the surface there are all these ripples. And these ripples are interfering with each other. They're causing patterns. There's light, as it were, bouncing off the surface of them, causing them to gleam and to shine. And there's all this play of form, of phenomena. It's as if, with our ordinary eyes and our ordinary senses, we can just see these surface play, this surface form. And we take that for all that there is. But really, this is just the surface. And what's worse is, what we do is we identify with one of the ripples. So I become one of the ripples, and you become another one of the ripples. And then I get all anxious about that ripple's bigger than me, and or that one's better looking than me, and I'm about to get swallowed up by this one, and we crashed, and that felt a bit strange. We get into all of this angst because we've identified as me a tiny part of what's going on. Yeah. And perhaps enlightenment would be an expansion of our consciousness which didn't identify with anything on the surface, but which was the whole ocean, which could see the whole ocean. And it also could see the surface. It could see the play of ripples, but not mistake them. And then there wouldn't be any loss. There'd be nothing to lose, no one to ever be lost, because it's just all ripples in this vast, vast ocean that is always beautiful. Yeah. What's more, nothing is separate. How can anything be separate on the ocean surface? Everything affects each other. So that's an image, perhaps, for the enlightened mind, what might be going on. Perhaps I'm going to wind up now. I'll just finish with something that Einstein said, which I think is very beautiful, because what he starts to, in this quote, bring out is, if we're not separate, if this notion of a real me and a real world and lots of separation, you know, lots of real yous, is an illusion, then the natural response is compassion, yeah, is love. This is what's so important about the Buddhist path, is that when we see things more truly, what emerges is love. This is why the metta bhavana is said to point to reality. It's of the nature of reality, or it's pointing to that, because love is a natural arising when we see things as they are. And so the path of becoming more and more kind is a path of insight. And Einstein seems to point to that. He says, a human being is part of a whole called by us universe. a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, and he uses the word he, I'll come back to that. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to the affection of a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion, to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in all its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such an achievement is in itself a part of that liberation and a foundation for inner security. I'll read that again, and this time I'll use the word she. A human being is part of a whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. She experiences herself, her thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of her consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to the affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion, to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in all its beauty. Nobody is able to achieve this completely, but the striving for such an achievement is in itself a part of that liberation and a foundation for inner security. Isn't that beautiful? Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you. Thanks very much.